You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On April 20th, 1989, the nearly dead body of Tricia Miley was discovered in Central Park. Her skull was smashed so badly that nearly 80% of her blood had spilled onto the ground. Within days, five black and Latino teenagers had confessed to her rape and beating. In the Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding, Sarah Burns traces the media frenzy that ensued after the young men were arrested and then tried as adults, and tells the story of their incarceration and what life has held for them after their release. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Sarah Burns to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In the preface of your book, you explain how you came to know the Central Park Five: Antron McCrae, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Yusuf Salam, and Corey Wise. How did you?
Well, I was considering law school when I was an undergraduate, and I spent a summer working with the civil rights law firm Moore and Goodman, a very small firm. They're involved now in the civil suit on behalf of the five against the city for the wrongful convictions. And I learned about the case then. I was too young in 1989 to really be paying much attention, actually. And
although it was on every newspaper, every television show.
It was. It was front page news, you know, every day for a week and then throughout the next year of the trial. But I learned about the case then, actually, in 2003, and met a couple of the guys then and ended up writing my senior thesis in college about the case. So.
Well, can you remind us of what happened to Tricia Miley when she went for a jog in the park?
Sure. It was after dark. It was about 9 p.m. when she left. She was an investment banker who worked at Solomon Brothers and often worked late hours and so had to jog after work. And she was attacked while she was running along the 102nd Street Cross Drive, which connects the East and West Drives in the northern end of the park. And she was hit from behind and dragged from the road. It was a brutal attack. She was raped and beaten around the head, a fractured skull. And as you mentioned, she essentially bled out. And she was left for dead there, lying in a puddle.
Now, she's been a guest on the show a few times. And one of the things she had to deal with beyond all of these other things is that people judged her for jogging in the park because it was considered a dangerous time.
It was, and I think there was even a sense that the northern part of the park especially was dangerous because it was close to Harlem, and people in the city at that time had a sense that that's where crime was coming from predominantly minority neighborhoods. But I actually think because she remained anonymous for such a long time, and for the most part the press really respected that sort of unwritten rule to keep her name private, I think she suffered less than many rape victims do from the sort of blame the victim mentality that we see in a lot of cases. She was in some ways put up on a pedestal, but there are always those people who are going to say, what was she doing there? She should have known better.
And 89 is kind of late in the game, but from through the 70s into the 80s, there was a sense that New York was just rampant with crime.
Absolutely. And crime rates were higher then. I mean, I think the murder rate peaked in 1990 or 91, above 2,000 murders that year. And so there was legitimate fear, but I think also an exaggerated fear of crime, and particularly of who people expected to commit crimes. I think that plays very much into this case, that black and Latino teenagers were particularly feared as potential criminals.
But on the other hand, you cite research that that points out that even though anecdotally it was felt that the city was rampant with crime, it was mostly in the poorest neighborhoods that one had to worry.
Exactly.
And Harlem in the 1980s, you write, had the highest mortality rate of any area in the city. It was determined that men were less likely to reach the age of 65 in Harlem than they were in Bangladesh.
Right. And in fact, one of the sort of ironies of it is that those people who are most suspected of being criminals and that I would say whites feared most in that sort of larger fear of crime that was going on were those who are most likely to be the victims of crime.
So why was there this sense that throughout the city crime was out of control? Was this something that was created, a fear that was created by the media or by the police or the politicians?
I think in part it was created by the media. Certainly the most salacious crimes of the decade are going to be splashed across the front page, and the local news definitely gave a sense of the sort of body counts that you would see. But in fact, the crime rates were higher. So there was something to be afraid of. But I think that the idea that the crime that was focused mostly in very poor neighborhoods was going to spill into wealthier neighborhoods was greatly exaggerated in the media.
And there were random acts of violence that would occur throughout the city, and then they would be used to make people afraid.
Exactly.
So, and you cite a few in the book as well. But you spent some time laying out the night of April 19th, 1989, the activities of Andron, Kevin, Raymond, Youssef, and Corey. The series of events of that night became known as the Wilding. What were they doing?
They were part of a group of at least 30 teenage boys who came from Harlem and went into the park that night around the same time that Tricia Miley was heading to the park. And this larger group participated in a series of sort of harassments and assaults in the park. A few bicyclists were sort of threatened, and then two men were actually assaulted, beaten up. One male jogger who'd been running by the reservoir spent two nights in the hospital. So certainly some crimes were committed in the park that night by this group.
By these guys in particular?
It's unclear what these five, if had anything to do with that. We know who the sort of primary assailant in those more severe attacks was, and it wasn't any of these guys. So,
did any of them have criminal records?
Have
they had any run-ins with the law before?
None of these five had never been arrested before, had no experience with the system.
And then they confessed. Why would they confess if they weren't guilty of the crime?
Yeah, it was actually, as I started working on this, researching this book, it was the first thing I had to study, because it's so hard to understand why someone would ever falsely confess that I needed to understand how that was possible.
Well, we've heard of false confessions in the past. Usually some psychologically troubled person is kind of induced to confess. But we're talking about five young men. You would have thought one or two would have held out.
Right. Well, when you think about it in the context of there being 30 kids and most of them were brought in, many of them did hold out. And I think these five were the ones who didn't. I think they were vulnerable in part because of their youth. They were 14, 15, and 16 years old. And because of their innocence. I mean, they hadn't been arrested before and weren't familiar with the system and didn't know to ask for a lawyer or that they could be targeted and just for having been there.
And a lot of pressure was put on them?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, what most people associate with this, what people saw in the media were videotaped confessions. And they're very convincing. They were very convincing to a jury. But they were taken many, many hours after these kids were brought in, after hours and hours of interrogations in which they didn't much sleep or eat or have access to, certainly to a lawyer in any case, in some cases not even to their parents.
And some very well-known people were involved in this, weren't they?
Yes. Well, the case was prosecuted by Elizabeth Letter, but it was overseen by Linda Fairstein, who was the head of the Sex Crimes Unit of the District Attorney's Office at the time.
She signed it. Now a best-selling author.
Who is now an author, yes. She's no longer at the DA's office. And, you know, some of the detectives who worked on the case also sort of worked their way up and were well-known for a number of cases.
Well, it was unclear that whether these kids did it or not. Why were they pressuring them so hard?
Well, some of the kids...
We're talking about experienced people in law enforcement.
Sure, yeah. Some of the kids had been arrested as they left the park that night, and others were brought in within a day or two. And so some of these kids were already in custody at the Central Park precinct when the jogger was found in the park. And so I think, somewhat understandably, the police suspected the kids. They'd been in the park committing other crimes, and here they were already in custody. So it was not illogical to suspect them. But the problem is that I don't think they thought carefully enough about it, and they pushed so hard and used the tactics that they are so good at when they're convinced someone is guilty that it didn't leave a lot of room to reconsider when the facts didn't match up.
My guest is Sarah Burns. Her book, The Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding. It's published by Knopp. And you, at that time, were connected with the law firm that was enlisted to support them?
I spent a summer during college doing research for them, and then some time after college working on completely unrelated cases. But I did do a little bit of research on this case with them.
And the boys recanted their confessions almost immediately.
as soon as they got themselves out of the interrogation room, I mean, really the way interrogations work is they terrify you into thinking that you are never going to get out of the situation. There's no way out. And so that when the idea of giving a statement is presented, it seems like a way out of a terrible situation. And that if you confess, or in this case, they thought they were going to be witnesses, and that they would be testifying against other kids and would be able to go home.
Because they had engaged in the wilding.
Because they'd been in the park and they were afraid, and the police are very good at making them even more afraid.
Was there any forensic evidence that linked the five to the crime?
None, in fact. It was the very early days of DNA testing, and they were able to get a DNA sample from the crime scene, and it matched none of the kids they'd arrested who'd been in the park.
And that didn't seem to matter?
Well, I think by that time there was a sort of tunnel vision that had set in where people were very convinced that these kids were responsible, and so they came up with a sort of theory to ignore that fact by suggesting that, well, there's just one other guy we haven't caught. But the fact that there was only one sample, not the several that you would expect with a gang rape, didn't seem to make anyone reconsider.
Was Tricia Miley able to testify at the trial?
She did testify at the trial, but she had no memory of the events of that night. She suffered a traumatic brain injury. The beating was that vicious. And so she had nothing to contribute about who might have committed the crime, only about her whereabouts that evening.
Now, a police officer from the 23rd Precinct actually stopped Matias Reyes, the real rapist, on his way out of the park.
Yeah.
Would he have been somebody they might have suspected?
No, in fact, the reason they stopped him was because they knew him, because he worked at a bodega across the street from the precinct. And so they stopped him and asked him if he'd seen a group of kids in the park that night. This was before the jogger had been discovered, so they were just looking for a group of kids who were harassing people in the park. And he said no, and they let him go on his way, I guess not noticing his what must have been blood-stained clothing.
At one point, did he become a suspect?
He did not become a suspect until he himself confessed in 2002.
That's because he'd committed other crimes?
He went on, after he raped the Central Park jogger, he went on to rape at least five more women that summer, and was eventually caught and pled guilty to some of those other crimes.
Well, there must have been some kind of pattern to these crimes. Didn't anybody notice that they were similar to the one involving the Central Park jogger?
Yeah. I mean, again, you would think, but I think this tunnel vision sort of prevented people from seeing that. But yes, I mean, he committed his other crimes on mostly on the Upper East Side, very close to where he'd raped the jogger in the park. He'd actually raped another woman just 2 days earlier in Central Park, not far from where the Central Park jogger was raped. But that crime he was never actually convicted of. But they were able to discover his name when the victim gave a description of that crime. So I believe that they could have caught him then had anyone been really looking hard enough for him.
When did anyone think about trying to connect his DNA to the Central Park jogger case?
Only after he came forward and confessed.
So he confessed to it first. Now, why would he have confessed to it?
Well, he and Corey Wise, who was one of the five, Corey served the longest sentence because he was 16 at the time of his arrest and therefore sentenced as an adult. And so he and Matias Reyes were both in Rikers in 1990 awaiting their trials. Obviously, Corey had no idea who this man was, and they'd had a little argument over the television. And then 12 years later, they were both in Auburn Correctional Facility in New York State, and Reyes came up to Corey and apologized for this fight they'd had many, many years earlier. And Corey said, "It's fine. It's not, you know, it's water under the bridge." And they had a nice conversation, and just after that, Reyes started seeking people out to come forward and confess that he had committed a crime and that someone in the facility was serving time for something that he had, in fact, done.
So he was feeling guilty.
That's what he says. And I mean, we'll never know. Other arguments have been made, but he doesn't say that it was a religion thing, though. He said he was trying to become a better person, but I think we'll never know.
My guest is Sarah Burns, who's written a book called The Central Park Five, a chronicle of a city wilding that is published by Knopf. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Sarah Burns, who's written a book called The Central Park Five, a chronicle of a city wilding, published by Knopf. There were calls for the death penalty for the Central Park Five at the time, even though they were teenagers.
Yeah, Donald Trump placed ads in the four daily papers in the city calling for the return of the death penalty. He said, bring back the death penalty, bring back our police.
And he wasn't even running for president at the time.
He wasn't. And he, while he didn't specific, it was clear that he was referring to this case when he published those ads. It was just a couple weeks after the crime. And, it, you know, exactly as you said, they were under, they were 14, 15, and 16 years old. The death penalty wouldn't have applied. It also wouldn't have applied because there was no murder. Rape is not a crime that is eligible for the death penalty, even when it did exist in New York. And the fact that people were jumping to these conclusions so quickly, so early, before the facts were in, before the DNA tests had come back, was part of this real sort of railroading that was going on. I mean, people really jumped to conclusions and didn't want to let go.
Well, you open your book with a quotation from then-Mayor Ed Koch just 2 days after the crime. He said, I think that everybody here, maybe across the nation, will look at this case to see how the criminal justice system works. This is, I think, putting the criminal justice system on trial. Now, he had no idea what he was really saying there.
No, he didn't. That's why I like that quote so much. He, I think, really, given the fear of crime that was swirling around the city at the time, I think there was a sense that getting justice, which meant convicting these kids, was going to be a step towards sort of restoring order in the city, and the system needed to prove that it could do that.
What was your sense of the trial? They had recanted their confessions, but they were still used in the case?
They were. They were presented both written and videotape statements. Four of them had given videotape statements as well as written confessions. And so, yes, those were presented at trial. It was really the only evidence that was presented against them. The DNA tests had come back negative. There was no other forensic evidence linking them to the crime.
And no witnesses?
And no witnesses.
And what happened with the other kids who were involved with the Wilding? Did they catch any of them? And did they say anything about this?
Some of them who were in the park did eventually plead guilty to lesser crimes related to the other incidents in the park and served short sentences or probation.
But they didn't appear as witnesses against the Central Park Five.
No, they didn't, because they had all stated that they had no knowledge of it and had stuck to that throughout. And so there was nothing for them to say.
How long did each of the five serve in jail?
They served between 6 and 13 years in prison. Corey Wise, as I said, because he was 16, was sentenced as an adult. They were all tried as adults, but the sentencing rules were different for the younger guys. And so he served 13, almost 14 years.
And they were released before they were exonerated?
They were. They all completed their sentences and were conditionally released and registered sex offenders after they got out for a number of years. And it wasn't until Matias Reyes came forward and confessed. And the district attorney's office did a very thorough reinvestigation, I think, to their great credit. Really went back and took a hard look at what had gone wrong and concluded that, in fact, the convictions should not have happened, that they shouldn't have tried the case in the first place. And had they had this evidence about Reyes, they wouldn't have. And eventually the convictions were vacated in 2002.
Now, on the night of the Wilding, Corey's mother was sent all over the city looking for her son. She was pregnant at the time?
Yes. In many cases, the parents were I think kept in the dark about what was going on, and that, I think that was part of the police strategy for interrogating these kids.
I mean, to isolate them.
Was isolating them, exactly. It's a part of any interrogation is a feeling of isolation. And so while the rules stated that anyone under 16 had to have a guardian present, the police have a number of ways of keeping that guardian from being effective in some cases, keeping them in the dark about how serious the charges were. In one case, Kevin Richardson, after his mother, who was so ill that she had to go home, his 21-year-old sister took over and had no idea what was going on. They hadn't told her anything. She came in the middle of this and wasn't really able to protect him very effectively.
Well, but often in these kinds of cases, the kids come from troubled families. And in this situation, almost all these kids came from rather stable families.
They did. They had loving parents and—
You have photos in the book.
Yeah. You know, these are decent kids. They are in school and they have nice families. I mean, Antron McRae was an only child, two parents. His father was actually his stepfather, but who had raised him. coached his little league team. He played in Central Park. He was a great shortstop, even at, 5'3" or less. I mean, tiny kid, great athlete. And, these kids, they came from stable homes for the most part.
So they spent their late teenage years and then their early 20s in jail. And then they were released, but you say, as registered sex offenders. Mm-hmm. Why were they released? Because they were just too young to have longer sentences?
Exactly. The sentences were capped at 5 to 10 years. That was the maximum for juveniles. And so they served up until they got essentially time off for good behavior. So,
Has that affected their life after jail?
Absolutely. I mean, they were able to continue their educations in prison. All of them got GEDs, and most of them, they all at least began college programs and did those until the funding was cut, and those programs are no longer available to them. But, I mean, they lost years of their lives, and, as you said, their adolescences. I mean, they were teenagers, and they didn't get to finish high school with their peers. And then as they were released, as registered sex offenders, it's almost impossible to get a job. And so for many years, they struggled, even after their release, trying to get their lives back on track.
Did their families ever give up on them?
No. I mean, all of their families—
They all believed that they had not done it?
Believed in them and visited them while they were incarcerated.
So now the Central Park joggers are 22 years older than they were. That means they're all in their early middle age. What are they doing today?
Well, I think obviously things have been very difficult for them, and they're now, having been exonerated almost 8 years ago, they've had a little bit more of an opportunity to get their lives on track and to find gainful employment. When they're all working and some have families, but clearly they lost so many years that their lives will never be the same. And it's still been a challenge for them. I mean, Raymond Santana, he talks about how his life was on hold for so long that he thought that by now he would have a family, he'd be married and have a house and a car and these things that he has not achieved yet.
So why has the lawsuit that Antron, Kevin, and Raymond filed on December 8th, 2003 taken so long to move forward if this is so open and shut?
Yeah, well, there are some people who still argue that the five did have something to do with the rape, even though the evidence simply does not support that position.
Who argues that?
Some of the detectives and prosecutors who originally worked on the case. So the district attorney's office reinvestigated and concluded that they were innocent. The NYPD commissioned their own reinvestigation that suggested that, in fact, they had something to do with it, maybe before or with Matias Reyes. They'd somehow been involved. And some people have been very vocal about that.
Even though there's no indication that they even knew Matias Reyes?
The district attorney's office looked, and they found no connection between Reyes and any of the kids in the park. And the DNA matched Reyes, as it had not matched any of them. And Reyes's story was very accurate. He knew where the jogger was running, what she was wearing, exactly where she was when she was attacked, and her, as they say, post-attack state, how he left her.
But law enforcement often holds out, even when it's quite clear that the evidence no longer pans out, partly because they're afraid for their own jobs. You could be sued as well. Also because every time a case like this occurs, somebody can use it as proof that a confession isn't necessarily a true confession. I mean, it really undermines the legal system, doesn't it, in many people's minds?
I think so. I think that's probably at least a part of what's happening here when people continue to claim that these guys had something to do with the crime.
Amy in Manhattan asks if our guest, that means you, has any suggestions for how railroading of suspects by the police, the DA's office, politicians and the media can be prevented.
One of the top things that people suggest to try to prevent false confessions in particular is the videotaping of all custodial interrogations, not just after many, many hours of interrogations, but from the very beginning. And the Innocence Project, for example, recommends that as a really important way to stop false confessions from happening. And a number of cities and states have programs like that, and New York City has actually just begun a pilot program testing out videotaping interrogations from the very beginning in a couple of precincts, and I hope that they will continue that program and expand it.
Dan in Chelsea left this comment. He said, I worry about revisionist history of New York City in the 1980s. I grew up in Park Slope and went to high school at LaGuardia High School behind Lincoln Center from 1988 to 1992. I was jumped on my block two times in Prospect Heights and at school two times. Gangs would show up at our high school and other schools just looking for fights, called wilding. We would get out of school early because the principal would say that reports were coming in of gangs heading to the school. The subway was frightening all times of the day, and no neighborhood in Brooklyn was safe. Just about every single friend of mine was jumped at least once. Statistics are not enough to give a true picture of life at that time. And a number of listeners have left comments along the lines of Dan's. So are we in danger in telling this story and saying that these kids were railroaded, of forgetting that this was a scary time and that people had a good reason to be afraid?
No, I think it was a scary time, and I think that that context really informed how people dealt with this crime and what they thought had occurred. And it's absolutely right. I mean, Yusuf Salam, one of the five, had attended LaGuardia High School and talked about those same things, about being afraid of the gangs that would target kids from LaGuardia.
But the Central Park Five are all worried about the impact of racial profiling, because that's what caught them?
Well, they were picked up because they had been in the park that night, but I believe that the sort of the efforts to interrogate them and to get those confessions so quickly, and then the refusal on the part of the police and prosecutors later on to reconsider, I think that was fueled by the media. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that people assumed the worst about kids who looked like them and who came from Harlem.
So we had three kids filing a suit on December 8, 2003. And then Yusuf and Corey joined in the lawsuit?
They did. They all filed suits. They just had different lawyers at the time, though it's now all been consolidated.
So. Well, they hadn't all been tried together, had they?
No, there were two separate trials, which was really a result of the fact that they weren't – they'd made these statements, but the statements couldn't be used against the others. And so they would have had a really hard time trying them all together and trying to use these statements without anyone mentioning each other. So they split the trials in two.
How much are they suing the city and other agencies for?
They and their families are each suing for $50 million.
Wow. And would that be aimed at just agencies, the city, or are there individuals as well?
There are individual named defendants, I believe. The suit is against the city and the NYPD, as well as some of the prosecutors and detectives who tried the case.
In your estimation, will someone end up trying to compensate the Central Park Five?
I don't know. It seems right now that the
Maybe
city...
Maybe Donald Trump?
That doesn't seem likely. He has not apologized or really made any statement about his ad. In as far as the lawsuit, it really seems that the city is determined to go to trial and has no intention of settling. They've made that pretty clear of late. So I think it'll be up to a jury.
After the verdict was vacated, are they no longer labeled as sex offenders?
Right. The conviction being vacated essentially means that it's as if the trials never happened at all.
But on the other hand, from what I know about the internet, certain things never go away.
Sure, and the media called them wolves and savages and beasts and things like that, and you can't really erase that from our collective memory, I think.
And it is ironic that one of the Central Park Five wanted to be a prison guard or a police officer.
He did.
So what about the legacy of this whole thing? Ed Koch, as I said earlier, said people will look on this case to see how the criminal justice system works. He said putting the criminal justice system on trial. Has it been put on trial as a result of this case?
Well, I think if we're looking to see a verdict in this case, that certainly the system failed. We got it wrong. And I think it's not just an indictment of the system and those who worked on the case, but of our sort of culture at large. I mean, the media coverage of this almost never used the word alleged, for example.
Mm-hmm. They never said alleged.
No. People were so sure that these kids had committed this crime that there was really very little opportunity for anyone to reconsider that. And so I think everyone jumped on this bandwagon very early on.
But don't you think that's always the case with a sensational crime? We're seeing it right now with Dominique Strauss-Kahn. I don't know whether he committed the crime. I'm assuming he did. It sounds plausible, but I don't know. And he's going to defend himself. Supposedly innocent until proven guilty. And yet, I think pretty much as everybody has decided in this case, and you don't see the word alleged very often.
I think so, too. And I think that's the danger.
So we didn't learn anything.
In these tabloid cases is that people forget that we are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And that wasn't the case with the Central Park Five.
You're making a documentary with your father on this?
Yes, for PBS.
Your father's Ken Burns.
Yes.
and this will be – actually, that's kind of a departure from the kind of documentary that he has made in the past. But you do have an awful lot, I'm sure, of footage that you can use.
Yeah. I mean, New York in the 80s is a really it was both a scary place but also, I think, vibrant in a way too. And so the footage of that time in general is amazing.
Has Tricia Miley consented to appear in the documentary?
No,
because she has talked about the case. She's been on the show a couple of times.
She has talked about the case, but I think she prefers to focus on her recovery. And as a survivor of a traumatic brain injury, she speaks a lot about how she recovered from that. And it really was a miraculous recovery. They at first expected her not to live, and she's come back and she ran the New York City Marathon after. So I think she tends to focus more on that rather than the wrongful convictions that occurred in the case.
And she has nothing to apologize for because she never accused these kids of committing the crime.
Right.
But we're seeing we have the Gabrielle Giffords case now, and in some ways it's kind of similar, isn't it? Most of the focus initially was on the crazy guy who shot her. And now it's on her recovery.
Her recovery, yeah. And I think people really became very invested in the fate of the Central Park jogger then. She was not named until many years later when she wrote a book. But, there were press conferences at the hospital, and the media covered each little step towards recovery in a very similar way, I think, as we're seeing now with Gabrielle Giffords.
Every time there is this sort of crime, there is a call for reinstatement of the death penalty or application of the death penalty, because I think you can still ask for it in the state, although we haven't imposed it for a while. And it's been pointed out that in any number of instances, the wrong person has been convicted. So why do you think people still want the quick imposition of the death penalty? If these kids had been a little older, they might very well have been tried that way.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that outside of any moral arguments you could make about the death penalty, just the very fact of how many wrongful convictions we know have taken place, I think should be enough of an argument against executing people, because we it's not an infallible system.
Well, that's why we have the Innocence Project and some other people fighting against the automatic imposition of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that if I were to poll my audience, at least 50% would say that they would like to see it reinstated. Do you think that the civil suit will actually move forward this fall, possibly be settled?
It doesn't seem that it's likely to be settled. The city has indicated that they're not that they intend to go to trial. And I think that it's taken, I mean, the suit was filed in 2003, and it's been very, very slowly winding its way through the system. I think at the earliest, a trial could begin later this year, but that assumes that there are no further delays, and I expect there to be more delays.
Well, there are two things that they would be fighting, which would be wrongful conviction, being railroaded, but also their ability to earn decent living, as you point out, has been hampered as well.
Absolutely.
Is that something that could be determined in court?
I'm not a lawyer, and so I don't know exactly how that works. But that is, I mean, part of what a jury would decide is not only whether they were wrongly convicted and should be compensated, but also the damages involved in what they would be owed by the city.
So when will we be seeing the documentary by you and your father?
We expect the film to be on PBS in early 2013.
Uh-huh. Meanwhile, Sarah Burns will be participating in a panel discussion called The Lessons of the Central Park Jogger Case tonight with Raymond Santana, one of the Central Park Five. And who else?
Jim Dwyer, who is a reporter for the New York Times, and Barry Scheck of the Innocence Project.
And that'll be at the Jacob Burns Moot Courtroom, which is part of the Cardozo School of Law at 55 Fifth Avenue at 6 o'clock. And Sarah Burns' book is called The Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.